From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. A show today about the Chesapeake. First, a book called A Biography of a Map in Motion. It's the backstory of a map by 17th century trader, diplomat, and immigrant Augustine Herman. Towson history professor Christian Coate says Herman's map was a revelation.
There's incredible detail along each waterway. There are soundings indicating the depth of waterways. Individual plantations are marked. So essentially, the map is this incredible rendition of the Chesapeake.
The map was a godsend for merchants who traveled from Delaware to Virginia and for Lord Baltimore, who wanted to show off the growth of his colony. Then, fast forward four centuries, Carl Blankenship, editor of the Bay Journal, on why the record growth of underwater grasses is a good sign for the Bay's health. All on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Before satellites and smartphones, before speedboats or sonar equipment, in 1660, Augustine Herman, a merchant and diplomat from the Dutch colony of New Netherland, approached the proprietor of the Maryland colony, Lord Baltimore, and offered to create a map detailing the waterways and communities surrounding the Chesapeake Bay. In exchange, Herman was permitted to establish Bohemia Manor, an immense plantation in what is now Cecil County. A decade later, Augustine Herman's map, Virginia and Maryland as it is planted and inhabited, was published in London. It depicted in more detail than ever before the depth of shipping lanes in the bay, as well as marshy areas, sandbars, plantations, and Native American settlements. Who was Augustine Herman? How did he create this map? And what is its historical significance? Christian Coate, Associate Professor of History at Towson University, has taken up these questions in his new book, A Biography of a Map in Motion, Augustine Herman's Chesapeake. Christian Coate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
When and where did you first meet this map?
I met this map in reading about the 17th century Chesapeake. It's a map that shows up in almost every book about the 17th century Chesapeake, and I was engaged in a project that was looking at the involvement of Dutch traders in the early Maryland colony. And it uses an illustration in many maps. I also met Herman himself as part of that project, as one of these New Netherland traders that was working in colonial Maryland. And I suddenly realized that nobody had really connected his story, which some people had begun to tell about a trader who is a Dutchman trading in an English colony, and the map itself. And I became interested in what that map could tell us about his life and about the world he lived in.
So who was Augustine Herman?
He was one of these fascinating early American characters. He was born originally in Bohemia. We don't know exactly when, but probably in early 1620 or in 1621. He then fled religious persecution and ended up in the Dutch Republic in what becomes the Netherlands today, where he got a job, as many young men did, working for a mercantile firm that was one of the first to trade in New Netherland, the colony that the Dutch had built where New York City is today. And he was engaged largely as a fur trader. This is a time in which the population of New Amsterdam, the key capital city, is only about 400 people. And very quickly, he also began to move about the area, moving up the Hudson River, what becomes the Hudson River, engaged in the fur trade, but then soon also to the Chesapeake, to Maryland and Virginia. And quickly, as he begins to cross borders, as he begins to make friends in English colonies and Swedish colonies, he becomes more important to the administration. And eventually, he becomes a diplomat for Petrus Stuyvesant, who's the director general, kind of the governor of New Netherland. And that's how Herman ended up in Maryland in 1660 as a diplomat working on essentially a border commission in which the Maryland and New Netherland are fighting about their borders. And Herman goes as one of the representatives for Peter Stuyvesant and the Dutch.
And he's basically arguing on behalf of the Dutch that they have a claim to part of Maryland.
That's right. The Dutch had long claimed what we now call Delaware, which was originally was part of Lord Baltimore's claim. So what they're essentially arguing about was the control of the, there were essentially several fur trading posts along the Delaware River that New Netherland said was part of the Dutch colony and that Calvert said was part of Maryland.
And Herman did not win that argument.
The argument essentially is not resolved. It's one of those fascinating meetings. We have a pretty good account of it from Philip Calvert, who is the secretary of the colony of Maryland and was the brother of Lord Baltimore. And at this moment, essentially, they all compare maps and these maps disagree. Now, maps were long used as legal documents in claiming land in the Americas. European empires believed that to journey to a place, to map it, to discover it, was a way of claiming that region. And as you might imagine, English maps and Dutch maps both claimed the same region. They both claimed that they had been there first. So essentially, they decide not to resolve the issue. It later will be resolved in the 1660s when the English expel the Dutch through an invasion.
But taking us back to 1659, does Herman stay in Maryland or go back home to New Netherland?
So when the meeting concludes, Herman realizes that one of the big problems is that there's no real good accurate map of the Chesapeake. And he immediately wrote to Petrus Stuyvesant, the Director General of New Netherland, and offered to draw a map, a much more accurate map than had existed. And Stuyvesant essentially ignores him. He then, several months later, makes the same offer to Lord Baltimore. This time, Lord Baltimore agrees and in return gives Herman a vast estate, what is originally more than 4,000 acres and was today Cecil County. So in exchange for drawing an accurate map of the Chesapeake, Herman becomes a Marylander. And he'll, the next year in 1661, move to what he soon calls Bohemia Manor, named after his homeland, and he begins to work on his map.
Augustine Herman often signed after his name, the Bohemian, a reference to his birth in Bohemia, which is now known as the Czech Republic. That identity was important to him.
It was. He was a man that left home as a young man. And that Bohemian identity becomes important because in the late 19th century, he becomes a hero for many Bohemian immigrants in Baltimore. It's one of the key places that Bohemian immigrants came to the United States. There are more than 10,000 Bohemian immigrants in Baltimore by the late 19th century here essentially to work in Baltimore's burgeoning factories. And they seize on Augustine Herman as a hero. And almost every year, the Bohemian Society of Baltimore, sometimes the Bohemian Society in the entire United States would come to Baltimore and rent a steamboat and go to his manor in Cecil County and have a party, have essentially a summer celebration. So it becomes a tie for Bohemians to the past. And it's in fact that Bohemian community which enabled by the 1950s Augustine Herman Highway in Cecil County to be named after him.
A big focus in your research is the imperial tension of the 17th century as the Dutch and the English rivaled for control over the Chesapeake. Why did Lord Baltimore commission this map? Why did he consider it so important?
I think there are two reasons to that. The first is he thinks that an accurate map can shore up his claims. And it's not just the Dutch that he's fighting with. This is a moment in which, as European empires are expanding into the Americas, land is being patented away by monarchs, being claimed by commercial companies, and the borders of these regions are often unclear. So Lord Baltimore is really stuck between Virginia to his west and south and New Netherland to his north and to his east. And what he wants is to be clear about where exactly the borders of his colony are. And the second reason is that this map will allow Calvert, to allow Lord Baltimore to display the growth and development of his colony. The map itself allows him to show what Maryland has achieved in the 30 years since it's been founded. It shows where plantations are. It shows knowledge of the landscape that shows the sort of future prospects that Maryland might have. If people can navigate to it, can find places, they can trade, and the colony can further grow.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Christian Coate, Associate Professor of History at Towson University. We're discussing his new book, A Biography of a Map in Motion, Augustine Herman's Chesapeake, which delves into the creation of a 17th century map of the Chesapeake Bay. Probably we should let listeners in on what this map looks like. If they want to see it, we have a link at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. But describe it.
So this map might look unusual to listeners. For example, north is to the right on this map. But essentially what you see centered in the middle of the map is the Chesapeake Bay. And clearly delineated on the map are the innumerable waterways of the bay. Each one of them, if your listeners zoom in on the digital version of this map, they can see that there's incredible detail along each waterway. There are soundings indicating the depth of waterways. Individual plantations are marked. So essentially the map is this incredible rendition of the waterways of the Chesapeake. Listeners will also notice that there's a lot less attention paid to the land on the map. The land is largely vacant on the map other than along the coastlines. It really is a map of the waterways of the Chesapeake, of both Virginia and of Maryland.
How did Augustine Herman go about collecting the data to draw this map?
What Herman would have done is slightly different than most other map makers in the period. Map makers making maps of smaller regions, particularly of estates and towns, would have surveyed that land, would have used surveying equipment, essentially a compass and chains, to measure distance and angles on land. But there's no way Herman could have done that for the entire Chesapeake. Instead, he drew the map as a navigator along the water would have. Essentially, he would have traveled up and down the bays and inlets of the Chesapeake, taking measurements from the sea, using essentially the principles of trigonometry to triangulate places over a long period of time. It took him at least 10 years to do, essentially gathering small amounts of data before combining those into the map that we see.
What made this map so much better than the maps that had preceded it?
Largely, it's the way that Herman went about collecting the data. Most maps before this, and the most famous of those is John Smith's map, which was constructed in the late 1600s, so 1608, 1609, was eventually printed in 1612. And that is a map of Virginia that's largely land-based, that shows the location of more than 100 Native American settlements and the small Virginia settlement, essentially, of Jamestown. It covers a smaller period and is largely focused on land. What Herman did differently by using the waterways enabled him to cover more distance and enabled him to essentially allow people to enter this space in a way that other maps didn't. Other maps largely were about claiming land, and that's what Smith's map was about. It was about claiming the land for Virginia, saying that this region is now part of Great Britain. What Herman's map was designed to do was allow people to move about the region. And one of the real key things about that is he comes from a very different perspective. He comes from the perspective of a mariner, of a merchant. And for him, waterways are essential, not land itself. And that emphasis is the perfect way to, in fact, picture the Chesapeake, which is most distinguished by its innumerable waterways. So he captures that environment in really rich detail.
And Augustine Herman also relied on information he'd received from Native American guys?
That's likely true. I mean, one of the things that it's hard to do is to prove that. But we know that there are a number of Lenape, particularly communities listed on the map that are very accurate, we know. I mean, these are places that archaeologists have found Lenape communities, so we're pretty sure about the accuracy of them. He moved in these regions. We know that he traded with Native Americans, and it was very common for early American map makers to get information from Native Americans, and that had been true from John Smith through Augustine Herman, and he too would have likely consulted Native Americans, though once again, we don't have the documents to prove that.
Was he still an active trader at the time he researched and made this map? He already had this big estate.
Yeah, he's continuing to trade during that whole period. And in fact, he ends up doing business with Lord Baltimore and some of Lord Baltimore's circle, helping them connect essentially Chesapeake tobacco even more fully to New Netherland through the 1660s. And he remains a merchant really through the 1670s. And then we see him sort of disappear. The way that we can tell his story is actually largely through court records. And those court records are evidence, essentially lawsuits about commerce. There are almost no other documents that exist from Harriman other than his map, a will, and one other document in which he details his land holdings. So we don't know exactly, but that he's not being sued after about the late 1670s, early 1680s, suggests he's withdrawn from commerce. And he later would die in 1686. So he had become older as well.
How popular was this map at the time?
We know that the map was not as popular as some other maps because there are actually only 6 copies of it left. And we know that probably only about 150 or 200 were ever printed, and only 6 remain. But what happens is that the map becomes incorporated into other kinds of maps. And this was a common way of making maps in the 17th century. What map historians call derivatives, which actually captures it very well, essentially the geographic information in the map gets copied into other maps.
It becomes the conventional wisdom.
That's exactly right. And one of the most important set of maps for the British Empire is a set of maps called the English Pilot, which essentially are maps of various regions within the Atlantic. And Harriman's map gets incorporated into those kinds of navigational manuals through the late 18th century. Even though there are more accurate surveys, it becomes the way that English people imagine the Chesapeake for more than 100 years after his death, in fact.
What an interesting story. Thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Christian Cote is Associate Professor of History at Towson University and author of A Biography of a Map in Motion, Augustine Herman's Chesapeake. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, you can see an image of Herman's map, Virginia and Maryland as it is planted and inhabited. Quick break now. On the Record, I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. We're talking about the Chesapeake Bay this morning. Earlier, we heard about a 17th century map that laid out all the rippling details of the bay's banks. Now we're diving into the bay to learn about underwater grasses. Joining us is the editor of the Bay Journal, Carl Blankenship. Welcome to On the Record.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why are we paying attention to grass in the bay? What role do underwater grasses play in the bay's ecosystem?
Underwater grasses are really one of the most important parts of the bay ecosystem. You know, historically, there were probably hundreds of thousands of acres of grasses in the bay. They formed like vast meadows in parts of the bay. They were food for waterfowl. They're important places for baby blue crabs to hide in. Juvenile fish stay in them for protection from predators. They put oxygen into the water. They buffer the shorelines from waves. They play all sorts of roles in the system. They declined a lot in the last century, and then in 1972 with Hurricane Agnes, a flood of nutrients and sediment went into the bay and really knocked them back. And there's been annual surveys conducted since 1984, and in 1984 there were only about 35,000 acres of them left in the bay.
But this is the third straight year that underwater grasses have reached record acreages, now surpassing 100,000 acres. What's causing them to flourish now?
There was a study with a team of like 14 scientists that was looking at data from the 1980s to the present, and they really said that bay grasses have come back because of a decline of nutrients in the bay over the past 30 years.
Nutrients meaning nitrogen, phosphorus?
Nitrogen and phosphorus. And that's important because grasses, like all plants, need sunlight to survive. And because they're underwater, they tend to need a lot of sunlight. And when there are nutrients causing algae bloom or sediment clouding the water, it cuts down on the amount of light that these plants receive. And that's really the driving factor which caused the loss of grasses over time. And it was also important because they pointed out that because of increased pollution in waters around the world, underwater grasses are declining worldwide, and this is like one of the few places and the largest place that they could point to where there was actually a recovery of underwater grasses.
This progress is not immune from setbacks in the future. You write that grass in the midsection of the bay, widgeon grass, is, quote, notorious for its boom and bust cycles, close quote. Tell us briefly about widgeon grass.
Sure. First of all, just overall, while underwater grasses are up overall, it's always like a fit and start thing. In some years, there's going to be more rain, more nutrients, more sediment, and they decline. And then in other years, they come back. Overall, there's been an increase, but the story is different in different parts of the bay. And in the middle part of the bay, where most of the grass habitat actually is, it's dominated by one species, widgeon grass, which is really sensitive. It's got a history of rebounding when conditions are good and disappearing when conditions are bad. And so it fluctuates more than any part of the bay. That's a concern. Historically, there were several species that lived in that area, and scientists are hoping that in time some of those species will move back in and give those grass beds a little bit more diversity. But that's certainly an area of concern that you don't want your recovery hinging on a single species.
That's Carl Blankenship, editor of the Bay Journal, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're debriefing him about some of his recent reporting. I want to turn from underwater grasses to how states are planning to clean up pollution from the bay. Last year, the federal government and states in the Chesapeake Bay watershed agreed to include the impact of climate change in efforts to improve the bay's health. They've used computer models to anticipate the scope of the damage they need to undo. What have they learned from those models?
They've learned, and this is really a fairly recent finding, that climate change seems to be having more of an impact on nutrient levels in the bay than they previously were thinking. They have a goal of reducing nutrients by 2025 and meaning to reducing nutrients to a level that would clean up the bay or restore its water quality. And so they were only looking at the 2025 horizon, and the thinking was that there wasn't going to be that significant of a climate impact in that period of time. But they discovered when they were looking at the, you know, in the models, they assumed like rainfall levels were fairly constant, and they were using weather conditions from the 1990s in the model, and they realized that precipitation's actually been increasing steadily, and there is about a 3% increase in precipitation from the 1990s through 2025, they're expecting, you know, if it stays in the track it's been on. There's other factors that come into play, but that's probably the biggest one in driving more nutrients into the bay, and it would result in about 3 to 4% more nitrogen reaching the bay than they were previously estimating. When you're struggling to, you know, looking for every pound of nutrient reduction that you can get, every additional pound that you have to offset becomes something more to worry about.
Because more precipitation means more stream water in the bay, and the stream water is carrying nutrients from the land.
Correct, yeah. The amount of nutrients, basically, the more rain that you have, the more nutrients are washed off the land and into rivers and then into the bay.
So will these new estimates affect plans the states have made for their cleanup efforts?
Yeah, it will. And so that's something that is still being worked out, because there is an agreement to address for climate change, you know, when they adopted the latest cleanup plan in 2010. And they didn't really have the information then, and they agreed that they would look at new information about halfway to the 2025 goal, which is now, and then incorporate climate change. And so they you know, have this preliminary work, and it's showing more nutrients than they anticipated. And there is a commitment to address that. It is a little bit hazy at this point as to whether or not they're going to actually address that by 2025 or if that's going to go beyond that. That's an issue that is still of debate among the states and EPA.
Carl, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
You're welcome.
Carl Blankenship is editor of the Bay Journal. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to Blankenship's recent reporting about the Bay. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.